This is Stand to Reasons, hashtag STR Ask Podcast. I'm Amy Hall, and hello, Greg Kokel.
Hi, Amy.
Once again, you're with me, and I'm grateful. Okay, let's start with kind of a tough question here from Jack. A Christian counselor told a wife that when her husband looked at pornography, it was the same thing as committing adultery, according to Matthew 5. Therefore, she has biblical grounds for divorce. Is that true?
No, I think this is terrible advice. And think about as a practical matter, if a person commits adultery once, real adultery, then that's grounds for divorce. If this counselor is right, then all a husband has to do is look at anything pornographic once. And when I say look, I mean look with the intent of gaining sexual pleasure out of watching. And this could happen, by the way, in a host of movies that you just happen to see on Amazon Prime, for goodness sake. I mean, it's hard. R-rated movies characteristically have sex in them in a way that, you know, that could be qualified as looking at pornography. Let's put it that way. Okay, so one look, if that is adultery, one look of that fashion, if that's adultery, is all it takes to have, for a wife to have grounds for divorce. This means like 98% of Christian husbands would be vulnerable to divorce on those grounds. Now, that doesn't mean that the view is false just because of the ramifications, but it ought to signal to us, like, this, if that's true, then this is the consequence. And this consequence is really, really extreme. It's maybe we better think twice about this. And the answer is, goes back to our basic principle of looking closely at Scripture. Because Jesus, in this particular case, wasn't talking about, he was not construing looking at a woman with lust in her heart, I'm sorry, with lust in his heart, as the same as the act of adultery, all right? And this is where the broader context of that section of the Sermon on the Mount comes into play, okay? Jesus is making an argument there, and here's, we're back to our same old broken record, boring rule, never read a Bible verse, right? But it solves all kinds of problems. Starting in Matthew chapter 5, I'm looking here, in verse 17, after the Beatitudes, Jesus does a commentary on the law. And what he says in his commentary, essentially, is that the law governs not just your actions, your physical actions, but your mental thoughts as well. It's not just what your body does, but also things that you say. And notice he starts out by talking about the murder. You have heard the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder. But I say to you, everyone who is angry with his brother is guilty before the court. Guilty of what? Of murder. Okay, so if we're taking that at face value, using the same applicational rule that is embodied in the question that was just asked, then when we are angry with other people, we have committed murder. And we are guilty before the court of murder. Really? Okay, well, what's the penalty for murder? It's capital offense. Okay, what Jesus is saying here, and then he goes on, by the way, and it's interesting because the way he construes this is that he has three characterizations on this issue. And in each case, the crime, if you will, gets more moderate, but the penalty is more severe. So listen here. Whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court, but I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be guilty before the court. Whoever says to his brother, you good for nothing, that's not as bad as angry, it seems, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court. And whoever says, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. Now, why does Jesus construe it that way? The magnitude of the error seems to be getting less, but he is increasing the penalty, so to speak. He's making a point, and the point is that the law governs not just your actions, but your attitudes as well. And so if you are angry with your brother, if you call him an empty head or just a fool, you have violated the law. And then he goes on and he gives some other illustrations, and one of them is adultery. You shall not commit adultery. Oh, you think you're okay if you didn't actually do the physical thing? If you look at a woman, verse 28, I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery in his heart. I pause there for emphasis. He's committed adultery with her in his heart. Just like somebody who is angry without cause to his brother or calls him rock or fool, whatever, is committed murder in his heart. Murder in the heart is not the same as murder. Obviously so. And adultery in the heart is not the same as adultery. Obviously so. When Jesus talks about adultery being a cause for divorce, he is not talking about adultery in one's heart. He is talking about adultery, the act itself. Just like when the scripture talks about murder being a capital crime, Jesus isn't now saying anger or calling your brother a nitwit is a capital crime. He is making the case here about the demand of the law, and the law demands perfection. And it touches not only on your external actions, but your internal attitudes. And this particular section, by the way, has a summary statement. It's the end of chapter 5, verse 48. Therefore, you are to be perfect as your Heavenly Father is perfect. And subtext, good luck with that. So what Jesus is doing in this passage is he's trying to demonstrate that no one is going to be justified by law, because the law's demand on us goes much further than the Jews of the time thought.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's Jesus' point. And so the simple way of putting this is adultery in one's heart is not the same as adultery. However, it is still a sin. And before, in God's court, it is still actionable. That's the point. The application this counselor was making is not a sound application. It is not appropriate in light of what Jesus said here in Matthew 5. No more than putting a person in prison for life for calling his brother a nitwit would be appropriate in light of Jesus' comments.
Jesus was trying to show them that they weren't avoiding sin just because they weren't having actual, you know, adultery with somebody.
Right.
So the difference here is, and we've talked about this before, Greg, the things that human courts police are different than the things that God does. God can judge down to, you know, he can judge our hearts. He can divide between bone and marrow, soul and spirit. I mean, he can see straight into us. He can judge
thoughts
those
and intentions, right?
Mm-hmm. And just because we can hide things from other people, that doesn't mean God can't see them and he will judge them. But the things that we do as human beings and we judge are on a different scale, because you cannot, it would be too much for a human court to judge things in the heart. That's not, they're not capable of it.
Right.
It's not their place. And so that is why you don't get stoned for saying you fool, whereas God can still judge you for that sin. But I thought that was a great point, Greg. I hadn't thought about that before, that if if it's true that that's adultery, then it's true, and the consequence of adultery should be the same, then it's also true the consequence for anger should be the same, which is obviously false.
That's right. That's right. By the way, I think you're right that in God's court, God can judge the heart, but in man's court, we can't do that because we only have access to actions, right? But that, of course, is a concept that is disregarded when it comes to hate crime legislation. And I've written regarding this that I think hate crime legislation is just flat out wrong because it takes an action that is illegal and punishable and then adds the gravity of an attitude to the punishment. Okay, I don't know if I put that quite right, but the point is if you assault somebody, that's actionable. But if you assault them because the court thinks you hate them, then your hate has an additional, your alleged hate has an additional punishment attached to the crime.
Greg,
and
it's
that
not
means
even,
this is a thought crime.
It's not even that they have hate, because obviously you must have some sort of hate or you wouldn't be killing people. It's a specific kind of hate towards a specific kind of person. So it's not even all hate. It's just a specific kind of hate. Mm-hmm. And you know what? It's funny, Greg, you bring this up. Because I have a question for you about this. So I'm going to skip to that question since it's come up now.
All right.
And this question comes from Eric. Greg has said that his concern with hate crime legislation is that it defines a crime based on what is in the mind of the criminal. How is this different from laws that determine the severity of a crime based on the criminal's intent, like murder versus manslaughter?
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of the best way to characterize this. In the case of murder, first degree versus second degree, what is being punished is the action. All right. Now, what is the nature of the action? Well, it could be something that's planned out, which is an act. All right. You plan it. It is, what is the legal phrase with... planned beforehand kind of thing. I can't think of the phrase right now. But the idea is that there are other actions that are attended to it, as opposed to something that is done spontaneously. So in the case of a first-degree murder, where one is lying in wait and plans in advance, all right, those are not just looking at the attitude. It is looking at other behavior, all right? And that other behavior makes the crime of killing more egregious than if somebody who comes into a house and finds his spouse committing adultery, then he pulls out a gun and shoots a guy. Okay, well, that's also still murder, but it's a different set of, let's think of this, circumstances. The circumstances are different. And so the assessment of the punishment is based on the different circumstances. So strictly speaking, they are not punishing some attitude. When you have first degree murder, you are punishing a different kind of crime, and therefore there's a different level of punishment for it. All right. In hate crimes, you are punishing the hate itself, and as you just pointed out, and I do in the article, Why Hate Shouldn't Be a Crime, I think is the name of the piece. You can find it on our website. Is that it's not hate, but only certain types of politically incorrect so-called hate that is actionable under the law. And so, as you pointed out, virtually every crime of violence can be construed to be animated by hostile intentions and hostile attitudes. If it's hostile intentions and hostile attitudes, then all these crimes can be aggravated in a certain sense by attitude, and therefore the punishment is greater. But we don't do that. We don't know what the attitude is, even if we can infer the attitude fairly accurately from the behavior itself. It doesn't mean that we are justified in punishing the attitude. Notice if you have a thought crime, it requires thought police. All right? If you have a thought crime, it requires thought police. That means people have to figure out what your thinking is, which thinking is itself actionable. All right? And this is just flat out wrong. This is among the most grotesque types of totalitarianism. It is a complete abuse of the law.
Right, Greg, as you point out, the it's not the thinking behind what they're doing that's being punished. It's the amount of time of planning. Was it something that they planned ahead of time? Planning something ahead of time, or even, you know, did they intentionally kill someone, or was it an accident? Let's say you even the Bible makes this distinction. If you drop something on someone's head accidentally, you did not do it out of any sort of desire to hurt them. That intent matters, because the intention is all that matters here. If it was an accident, it was an accident. There's responsibility if you intended to do it. And the longer you intend to do it, and the more planning you put into it, the more deliberate it is, the more responsible you are, because you could have turned at any of those points and you didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, ironically, mm-hmm. crimes of passion, which actually have more passion, are less punished because they're in the moment and there weren't anything that they planned out over time. It was just something that, you know, they lost control of themselves or whatever, and they had so much passion, something set them off and they kill someone. That's actually less responsible than the crimes that don't right. involve that, which is ironic because mm-hmm. it's the opposite of hate crimes.
You know, I'm on about page 1,000 right now of the Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, and I've just gone through a grotesque section that chronicled the physical abuses of the Third Reich on people. And many of these that committed these terrible atrocities did them impassionately. Is that the right word? Mm-hmm. Without passion. That is, they weren't angry. They weren't, I guess you could say they hated Jews, but they weren't motivated. It just wasn't the nature of the crime, it seems to me. But because it wasn't just Jews, it was also Slavs. It was even other Germans that where medical experiments were done on, for example. So, but it was, so in some cases, one, as you're pointing out, the fact that there's lack of emotion is evidence of a greater crime, and the emotion is a mitigating factor in the punishment. What I was referring to earlier, I couldn't think of the phrase, was malice aforethought. Okay, malice aforethought. Now, that sounds like malice aforethought means they had the thought of malice beforehand. But think about this. It isn't just the malice aforethought. If a person lies in wait for someone with malice aforethought and intends to kill them, and the person they're lying in wait for never presents themselves, so they can't do the act, the malice aforethought is still there, and the lying in wait is still there, and the attitude that motivated the planning of the crime was still there, but it's not actionable. You can punish an attempt, an actual attempt on somebody's life that doesn't succeed, but you can't punish somebody for lying in wait unsuccessfully with malice aforethought. But on the logic of hate crimes, you ought to be able to do that. All right. In the case of first degree murder, the malice aforethought is a phrase that captures the planning in advance, as I pointed out, to do this wrong, and that aggravates the crime, the moral mm-hmm. nature of the crime. It's an aggravating factor.
And think about it. The person who is killed, the punishment is to pay for the crime of taking that person's life. If every human being is equally valuable, then it doesn't matter why you killed them. If you are responsible, if you did it deliberately, then your crime is just as bad, no matter who you kill, because people are all, you know, equally valuable. Now, there could be some sort of terrorist aspect to this where that brings in an additional crime or whatever. But again, that doesn't involve thought police. And that is such a bad direction to go in. We don't want people policing thoughts. And what that means is that sometimes people will get away with things because this is not a utopian society. We cannot create a utopian society. We're fallen people. We can't legislate every little thing because that is not how society can work. That's not how a free society can work. But people, I think what happens is we get this utopianism in us and we want to have perfect justice now, and we just can't do that because you will bring in so many dangers by having thought police. That's and right. things like that to try and make everybody perfect.
Actually, thought police is arguably, and here I'm not being hyperbolic. It is an act of terror, because having thought police strikes terror into the hearts of people regarding what they do and say that is politically incorrect, because that's the kind of thoughts that are being policed, not all hateful thoughts. All right. So and I'm thinking of even movies that were made that trade on this notion. There was a movie that Tom Cruise was in where
Minority
they were
Report.
Able to see in the future. Yeah, Minority Report, where they saw in the future a crime that was going to be committed. And so they would arrest the guy before the crime was committed, but the person would still be guilty of the crime. And even though it would never happen, it was thwarted. And now, this isn't a perfect parallel, but it is. There's a similarity here where an intrusion, an inappropriate intrusion by the government brings terror on the people. Who knows? You never know when you're going to be grabbed. And this is how the movie plays itself out. Who's going to be grabbed and for what alleged reason? For something you haven't even done yet. But they allege you will do. So notice that just brings, that's a terrible, terrifying, terror-inducing government policy.
Mm-hmm. And we've seen how it turns out. We just have to look at the communist countries of the last 100 years to see how that turns
right.
out. Well, mm-hmm. thank you
or
for
any
the question.
Totalitarian dictatorships.
Yeah, that's true.
Like the thank Third you. Reich or communist China, etc.
Exactly.
Sorry, Amy.
That's okay. Thank you. Thank you for your questions, everyone. We really love to hear from you. Send those in on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.